But ask yourself, if we'd learned on November 22, 1963, that the Premier of Russia had been shot from a Moscow office building by a lonely capitalist sympathizer who himself was then liquidated by a patriotic Muscovite within 48 hours while surrounded by armed police, I think it would be pretty apparent to any free-thinking person that a coup d'etat and a transfer of power had just taken place in the Soviet Union. And we would not be asking questions or attacking Jim Garrison or his record. We would, in a free-thinking society, be asking hard questions about why he was killed and what forces were opposed to him. Y'all gotta start thinking on a different level, like the CIA does. Now, we're through the looking glass here, people. White is black, and black is white.
The government's been in bed with the entire telecommunications industry since the 40s. They've infected everything. They get into your bank statements, computer files, email, listen to your phone calls, every wire, every airwave. The more technology you use, the easier it is for them to keep tabs on you. It's a brave new world out there. At least it better be.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets.
Welcome back to Cloak and Dagger. Once again, we're here with Webster Tarpley. I'm your host, Lenny Bloom. This is www.cloakanddagger.ca. We're here to scrape the bullshit off the truth, a la Sherman Skolnick style. Webster, it's an honor to have you back here at Cloak and Dagger.
Thank you very much, Lenny. I guess this is the first time we've spoken since the U.S. elections.
That's right.
And things here in Washington are moving very, very fast. But let me take a step backwards, if I could, back to the election and say something about that. We had a very successful conference here on Saturday, DC911truth.org, with Colonel Bowman and Wayne Madsen, Michael Springman, the whistleblower from the State Department, Dan Abramson of False Flag News, Kevin Barrett from University of Wisconsin, and I put together an analysis, and I can't give the whole thing, but at least something. First of all, I would say that the precondition for the defeat of the Republican coalition is entirely the merit of the 9/11 truth movement. As everybody knows, Bush built his house on the demagogy of terror, and he tried to evoke the terror of 9/11 every time he turned around. He talked about it literally every day, has been doing so now for 5 years. And this was the first time that the magic didn't work, as Barack Obama, somebody I dislike quite a bit, nevertheless observed that the spell has been broken, the fever has broken. The ability of Bush to manipulate the U.S. population with at least this particular terror incident seems to be in rapid decline. So we know that several weeks before the election, there was this New York Times CBS poll that showed of the whole U.S. population, 84% were skeptical to one degree or another about the official 9/11 story. They either felt the government was hiding something or felt the government was lying in the majority of its assertions or didn't know, and there were really only 16% of the U.S. population who believed that story, and I think that was, out of all the statistics for Bush, even beyond Iraq, beyond Katrina, beyond anything else you want to mention, that was the one that sealed the doom of the Republicans, at least in the current form, because that meant that their main stock in trade, which was to try to terrify people with bin Laden and these other ridiculous patsy boogeymen, that this had gone. So now we've had these significant gains. I would say, actually, let's put it this way, significant losses for the Bush coalition. I think this is the beginning of a party realignment. I was looking for the party realignment to begin in 2004, but this was stopped by the vote fraud prowess of Rove and his gang of thieves.
Webster, do you see this as fitting into your cycle that you had talked about?
Yeah, this is the cycle. I'll just try to situate a little bit better. Since the beginning of the United States, there have been these cycles of party alignments, and they can be 32, 34, 36, or 40 years. And of course, when you're living through it, it's hard to tell whether it's going to be 32, 34, 36,
right,
or 40 years.
Right.
So you got to give me a little bit of benefit of the doubt on this.
Webster, do you think it's going to? Do you think the system will even more evoke itself, and we'll get 36, 24, 36?
I sympathize with your intent, even if I can't officially approve it. Let me just before we go too far.
Just
what are
spicing
these cycles?
It up a bit, Webster. Go ahead.
What are these cycles?
Yeah,
like, what are these cycles?
Let's go through them.
Well, in the U.S., this is not some eternal law of humanity. I'm sure that in the Shang Dynasty of China, and in the pharaonic Egypt, and in the Greek city-states, or the Minoan civilization, or the Polynesians, you didn't have 32 to 40-year cycles.
No, of course not. But it's the American history and a pattern that you've picked up that seems to be there.
That's what I would try to point out. At the beginning in the U.S., there were no political parties, right? There was just the revolutionary unity. But then in the Washington administration after 1788, there coalesced these two parties, the Federalists around Hamilton and indeed Washington himself, and then the Democratic Republicans around Jefferson. And if we take this first cycle, this first one is about 40 years. It goes from 1788 to 1828. And at the beginning, it looks like the Federalists are dominant with Washington, and John Adams. But then after that, it's straight Democratic Republican, Jefferson twice, Madison twice, Monroe twice. And then at the end, a very interesting one-term presidency of John Quincy Adams, one of the most qualified presidents, I would say, and one who would have been better if he had two terms. Then in 1828, you get a shift. The Federalists have ceased to exist, and they ceased to exist because they had supported the Hartford Convention and New England secessionism. So they basically withered away. They were gone. And this led to, in the 1820s, it led to something called the Era of Good Feelings. It meant that there was no partisan strife because there was only one party left. Right now we've had the Era of Bad Feelings, or we're in the middle of the Era of Bad Feelings. 1828 is a big turning point because this is now Andrew Jackson, a demagogue, an extremely destructive president, who comes in with the votes of the South and the West against the industrialized New England and the Northeast, and institutes this Jacksonian democracy, which is in reality pure demagogy, and this inaugurates a series of weak, one-term presidents. He also inaugurates tremendous economic crisis. The Panic of 1837 is all his fault. And basically, this is a disastrous cycle. It goes from 1828 to 1860, and it ends in a civil war. Worse than this, you couldn't get. Therefore, the Democratic Party, with their ridiculous Jackson cult, are completely misplaced, in my view, especially this question of the First Bank of the United States, Second Bank of the United States. So this was an awful cycle. Now, in the course of this, the Jacksonians are one party, and the other party is simply anybody who's against King Andrew. And since they were against the king, they called themselves Whigs on the British model. So the Whigs included the best and the worst of everything, just as long as you didn't like King Andrew. And they had some very bad people like Calhoun, awful secessionist, but then you had some very good people like, in particular, Henry Clay, and indeed Abraham Lincoln comes out of this, except that the Whigs can never really get it together. They only win two presidencies in this time, both times with war heroes, William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor, and some reason both of them die within a very, very short time of being elected. So this is now the first very grave suspicion of presidents being assassinated, right, and this stuff being hushed up. Anyway, in the 1850s, you get then the emergence of, first of all, of the Know-Nothings, right, a racist anti-foreigner party that comes and goes very rapidly because it has no answers to the big question. Something like what we have today in the form of the racist Minutemen, right? A purely xenophobic, anti-foreigner group that has no solutions to any problems, but just says blame the foreigners for everything and kick them all out and have retribution. In 1860, then, you get the inauguration of what I would regard as a very positive cycle. These are the Lincoln pro-Union Republicans who were going to dominate from 1860 to 1896. They win the Civil War. Of course, they failed to successfully reconstruct the South. That's a disaster. But in terms of the rest of the United States, it then emerges as the greatest industrial power in the world by a factor of two or three above all the other components. Naturally, also, there are tremendous distortions in the way that this wealth is then distributed, but the important thing is that it's produced, because without production, it can't be there. Anyway, this cycle is then followed in 1896 by another Republican cycle on a slightly different geographic basis. At this point, the Democrats become the party of free silver, the South, and the West with William Jennings Bryan. The reason that the Democrats can't win is because Grover Cleveland is hated so much because of the way he basically allows people to starve to death in the crises of the 1890s. So it's going to be another Republican cycle, and this one is a reactionary Republican cycle. It goes from 1896 to 1932. It's a disaster. This is the rule of J.P. Morgan. This is where you get the invisible government being consolidated. In 1895, 1896, when Grover Cleveland turns the country over to the House of Morgan, and then you're going to get the Maine being blown up in Havana Harbor, Spanish-American War, founding of the empire, the assassination of McKinley, who is not enough of an imperialist to suit the New York banks, therefore the coming of Theodore Roosevelt, somebody with a mental age of six. If you look at these pedophile problems in Washington, D.C., they start with him. This is where the liberal Republicans become this party, again, very heavily influenced by the psychopathology of a president with a mental age of six, in the words of the British ambassador. Not something that I made up. And then you got, of course, then the destruction of the Taft presidency by Morgan, the coming of Woodrow Wilson, all this. You're getting the FBI, the Federal Reserve, you're getting, above all, World War One, and just an awful series. And this is where the country really passes under the rule of an invisible government, which has spokesmen. Probably in the 20s, it's Andrew Mellon, pro-fascist Secretary of the Treasury. There's a new biography of Andrew Mellon that tries to rehabilitate him by this British scholar, David Cannadine. It's a monstrosity. Andrew Mellon is just a fascist and a thief, too, because he refuses to pay taxes. He thinks rich people shouldn't have to pay taxes. Nothing has changed. Then, of course, we get 1932. The most successful of all of these party realignments is the overwhelming victory of Franklin D. Roosevelt. It means that the Republicans, who have been the dominant party from 1860 to 1896, and then again, slightly different basis, from 1896 to 1932, they dominate the Electoral College. Now it's going to be a Democratic coalition, and not just any Democratic coalition, because this is now not the smelly Democratic Party of Grover Cleveland and Al Smith, which has, you know, it's a Wall Street party, it's a racist party. This now becomes Roosevelt and the New Deal, with tremendous positive content, fighting the Depression, and then going on, indeed, to prevail in World War II and so forth. And whatever you think of the United States, you've got to look, what are the alternatives? And if you look at the concrete alternatives to Roosevelt, they're all much, much, much worse. And, of course, the Wall Street banking community hates Roosevelt, tries to kill him before he comes in, tries to have a fascist march on Washington to get rid of him already in 1933, right? The Morgan coup, the Morgan plot, so these Morgan interests that now run National Public Radio. So this is very positive. Here we also get mass organizations, things like the labor unions coming in, and a tremendous increase in the standard of living. It's the first time in world history you have a society where the middle class is the majority of a big country. So this is, I can't really, you know, exhaust all of the positive features of this stuff.
Right.
The problem is, by the late 1960s, this is going to run into trouble because of the racist backlash of the American South against the civil rights laws, which are an integral part of the New Deal, and then the suicidal folly of Lyndon B. Johnson in letting the Harvard boutique, these people like McGeorge Bundy and so forth.
Alan Dulles.
Well, Alan Dulles is not. Alan Dulles is already back with Kennedy. By this time, he's out, and I think he's.
What about the Warren Commissioners?
I'm sure he's there. The Warren Commission, yes. Of course, the assassination played a big role. This is key. But the main thing I would say, the Vietnam War, and in this case, then it's going to be Averell Harriman, and it's going to be McGeorge Bundy, and so forth. So you've got this, and this of course destroys the Democratic Party. In 1968, at the Democratic National Convention, with Daley sending in these goon cops to beat everybody up.
Of course, Ford is still alive, which is really interesting.
Sorry,
Ford is still alive, and so is our Spector.
Ford is now going to be a figment of the next cycle because now you've got to remember, and I say this because I've heard a lot of people were saying in this last election, "Oh, don't vote; it's hopeless." Everything is hopeless. A lot of people are extremely pessimistic, and I can see why. I can perfectly understand a pessimistic analysis. But what I cannot understand and what I condemn is a pessimistic capitulation. In other words, the one unpardonable sin is despair, and you've got to get out and fight. You've got to mobilize, right? Be active or be radioactive. And I would always prefer an activist role compared to some passivity that says, "Well, there's no point." The thing you got to remember,
and especially in an age where the internet has taught us that it has the ability of putting billion horsepower entities at the hands of very, very simple things.
If you want to reach a million people or 2 million people, you can do that any day you want.
Narrowcaster
making a bunch of calls to some C-SPAN or talk radio or Larry King
on
television.
Exactly. As I say, Webster, a narrowcaster is broad catcher.
A narrowcaster is broad catcher.
Yeah.
I'll have to ponder that one, Lenny.
Yeah,
I'm a little bit.
That's the internet. Narrowcaster becomes broadcatcher.
Okay.
And the broadcasters become narrow catchers.
Concerning the cycle now, I think the 1968 cycle is coming to an end. But let's just think about this 1968 cycle. What is it based on? Again, it's based on the breakup of the Franklin D. Roosevelt National Coalition, which was, of course, big city machines, the solid South, a lot of racists, no way around it, but also blacks, because the black America found that they could get a better deal from the WPA and PWA, in other words, the projects of the New Deal that were designed to generate jobs. You could get a better deal working from them than you could for various, reactionary low-wage employers, especially in the American South. You had also intellectuals. You had soldiers during the war, largely pro-Roosevelt. Even farmers, when things got really rough in 1936, a lot of farmers also went. You could look at Roosevelt's victories in 32 and 36 and even 40 and see that he carries the vast majority of the farm states as well as most other places. So, because, of course, the New Deal was the only thing that was saving a lot of these farmers from being foreclosed on. So this is a national coalition. The activity of people like Newt Gingrich, who said so, was that the whole purpose of his life is to smash the national coalition that FDR had assembled. In the Electoral College, what we've had for the past 40 years is the dominance of the South. In other words, the most backward, the most reactionary, and in many ways the most racist part of the United States has taken center stage. Simply because the Republican Party could start by assuming most of the old Confederate states. Forget about New York. Forget about California. Forget about Illinois. They don't count. Because all you need now is the solid South, plus some border states, plus some Intermountain West, High Plains, some places like this. And you've got more than 270 in the Electoral College. So this is the tragedy. It also goes together with a complete smashing of the labor movement in full retreat, especially under Reagan, a rollback of living standards. The living standard under this 40-year cycle has declined by two-thirds, whatever the living standard was in 1966-68, it's minus 65% at this point. When you calculate all of the questions of real wages, how many hours a year do you work, how long are you commuting, how long are you stuck in traffic, what are your taxes, what are you paying for insurance, health care, tuition, all the things in a middle-class bill, interest rates, all the rest of this stuff. So it's been the dominance of Wall Street financiers mediated to the Southern Bloc in the Electoral College, and of course it's characterized by these bottom-of-the-barrel presidencies like Bush 41. Right now people are trying to portray Bush 41 as some kind of a wise elder statesman.
Right,
please
right.
Read my biography. He's a criminal. He's a killer.
Absolutely.
Bush 41 killed more people than Bush 42 in Iraq.
You mean Bush? No, Bush 43.
No, Bush 41.
There's no Bush 42.
No, that's Clinton.
Yeah, that's right.
So it goes from, and of course the question is, Bush the Elder is Bush 41.
Right.
The current Bush is Bush 43. In the middle is Clinton, the 42nd president.
Yeah, Bush
43. But this notion that Bush 41 was some kind of a paragon of virtue. He was, of course, a madman. He was hyperthyroid. He created the Iraq War. And, of course, what he did then was to institute those economic sanctions, which killed between 500,000 and 2 million Iraqis over a decade.
Oh,
that's more than Bush 43.
He's a Hitler.
Make no mistake.
He's a Hitler.
Absolutely.
He's a Hitler.
Absolutely.
He's
American
worse than Hitler.
Caligula. Again, I sort of wrote the book on this subject. Please look at it online. We've just celebrated the 10 year anniversary of my unauthorized biography of George Bush online, www.tarpley.net. And you can see he was a profoundly sick man, tremendous, I would say quasi-psychotic outbursts, hissing, vomiting, God knows, all the things that went with that hyperthyroid condition and his ranting that he wouldn't eat his broccoli, which was prescribed to him as a means of getting the hyperthyroid under control. So this was all crazy. So you have these kinds of presidents, you know, Reagan, the union buster. The Democrats in this period have been almost equally disastrous. Carter, of course, was a disaster. Turned the government over to Paul Volcker. Clinton, a tremendous disappointment with his horrible reactionary abolition of any kind of civilized concept of welfare. Anyway, this is the point is that this has been a period of reaction, disorientation, demoralization, because whatever your hopes were in the late 1960s, they've been trampled on by 40 years of horrible defeats. And, of course, one of the features of this last 40-year period is that it's been characterized by apathy, passivity, low voter turnout. The rates of voter turnout in the New Deal were sometimes twice what they are now. No surprise in 1936 or so to have, 60-70% turnouts compared to the 30-40% that are now typical. Now, this is changing. You could see that the campuses, after having been dead for more than 30 years in the 2004 election, got stirred up because they wanted to defeat Bush. They then went into profound depression again when that election was stolen with a coup d'etat. But you've also got now lots of indications that 10 million more young voters have come into the pool in this last election. The participation of youth voters in particular was down practically a straight line from about 1970 to 2002, and now it's turned up again. And I have not yet seen total voter turnout for the 2006 election, but I would bet that it is significantly up, at least from the previous congressional one, and it might even be up compared to the presidential election because people felt that their vote was going to make a difference. So now, just in terms of where we are right now, the turning points, we'll just focus on the recent one, 1932, 1968, 2008. So I think that's going to be it.
Right.
Each one of these are the great watersheds, 32, 68, 06. Each one of these is preceded by a kind of a prelude or a harbinger, which is a congressional election which shows you which party is the likely beneficiary of the actual realignment watershed election. Example, 1932 is the big moment, but the 1930 congressional election. By this time, you've already had more than a year of all-out economic collapse. The unemployment has been skyrocketing. Herbert Hoover is refusing to do anything because, of course, free market principles take priority over the lives of people. So a lot of people are very unhappy with this. The Democrats gain about 50 seats in the House, and because of the way it worked in those days, about 14 to 15 Republicans died during the several months between the election and the taking office. So by the time the Democrats formed this Congress in late 1931, they had a majority of two seats in the House. There was something like 218 to 216. And the Republican majority in the Senate was cut to one. So there was a clear indication that something big was in the works, okay? And that then became the New Deal. So from 1930 to 1932. 1966, I remember myself, all that summer you could hear Ray Bliss, the head of the Republican National Committee, saying, "Ah, we're going to win 40 seats in the November 1966 elections, because this is now increasing dissatisfaction with Johnson because of the Vietnam War. I'm afraid also because of the civil rights laws. There was a racist backlash in the South in many places and in the border states, and also because the standard of living had already turned south. The standard of living by 1968 was already beginning to fall, at least in many areas. So that was the end of the post-war boom reaching the United States. The beginning of the world monetary crisis had a lot to do with that.
Right.
The crisis of the British pound in 1967 and the U.S. gold and dollar crisis. That is a brush with a collapse of the dollar through a run on the gold stocks
right. In
March of 1968. So in that election, indeed, the Republicans won something like 50 seats in the House and significant gains in the Senate. And that was the preparation for Johnson dropping out, Humphrey then losing to Nixon, and then this horrible 40-year period of reaction that we've had. Now we're at the point, 2006 is clearly the harbinger, because now you can see the Republicans lose 30, 35 seats. It's still not clear. There are still 9 undecided seats where it's so close that recounts are being done. And, of course, there's a struggle on each side to cook the results. And the Senate going, although the Senate could go back at any time because of Lieberman, right, who is the resident detonator. In other words, as soon as the Democrats decide to do anything good,
yeah,
Lieberman can simply jump to the Republicans,
right,
and the whole
right.
thing is turned on its head. Although that will stir the population no end if old Joe tries to do that. So
uses his position to avert, would that be the right word?
Yeah.
Undermine the will of the people?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, that's his stock in trade. That's what he does. Just on this now, I think therefore we're on the edge, we're on the verge of the actual watershed, and it looks like it's going to be the collapse of the Republican Party. Now, there are two ways this could go. It's not guaranteed because we face really an unprecedented crisis. In 1932, it was a world economic depression. In 1860, it was a civil war. But what we have now is the threat of a world war and the collapse of the dollar and therefore a world economic depression, both together. In other words, in some ways, this crisis is the worst one you've ever had. It is a colossal crisis. Now, there are two things going on. On the one hand, you have the warmonger Democrat faction, and this is composed of Hillary Clinton above all. She is joined by somebody like Lieberman, by Rahm Emanuel, who was the completely incompetent bungler who prevented the Democrats from winning 20 to 30 more seats that they could easily have won, except that Rahm, I call him Rahm Bozo, but it's Rahm Emanuel from Illinois, congressman, former Clinton hack. He headed the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He would not give you money unless you were pro-war. He wanted pro-war Democrats. You had to be like Hillary. Finish the job in Iraq. Get ready to attack Iran. That's what he wanted. If you were willing to do that, he was for you. Now, he picked, therefore, a bunch of warmongers. I won't go through all the names. Most of them were defeated.
Yeah.
Tammy Duckworth in Illinois, the most famous. This poor woman, paraplegic, maimed, lost both her legs, nevertheless warmonger, $3 million defeated. Whereas there were Democrats with almost no money that either won or, and I think this is the most important case, Colonel Bob Bowman in the 15th District of Florida got 44% of the vote. He was outspent by his Republican hack opponent, Weldon, 10 to 1. It was something like 100,000 to about a million on the other side.
Right.
If Bob Bowman had gotten 500,000 of the money that Rombozo sank into the Tammy Duckworth fiasco,
right,
he might have won that seat.
Yeah.
And there are probably two dozen others that were there waiting. The other thing I would also stress is the question of the pedophile clique in the House, in the White House, in the Senate, the Republicans, the liberal Republicans, meaning financier Republicans, which means most of them, are vulnerable to their Christian fundamentalist base on values. And the clear values is the Christian fundamentalist base does not approve of pedophilia. And that is what Foley represented. That's the Craig Spence ring.
How are the Bushes able to, over the years, keep that covered up from the right?
Well, we've just had this very interesting case. Bill Maher, M-A-H-E-R, right, the comedian, very interesting guy. He had gone on television saying that he thought that Bush should be impeached for catatonia on 9/11, right, when he was told the country was under attack. He didn't do anything. If you claim to be president and you're told the U.S. is under attack, whatever else may be going on, and of course I would say much else is going on.
You're supposed
to jump up and do something. You're supposed to issue orders. You're supposed to say, call out the guard, scramble the planes, raise the DEFCON, do this, do that, go.
Yeah.
And of course he did nothing.
He sat there projecting
strength. He should be impeached.
Bush fiddled while Rome burned.
He didn't. He was catatonic while the planes were hitting the towers. And a lot of people are still very, very resentful about that. I would hope now that we're going to have oversight hearings, we've got to go back and revisit, why did Bush not respond to the warnings during August? Now, I don't believe these warnings at face value. The warnings to me are the U.S. listing agencies catch chatter from puppets of another part of the U.S. In other words, patsies talk. They blab. They're mythomaniacs. Part of their job. They've got to be noticed. You've got to be able to make a case that they did it. So the patsies are always yapping. U.S. listening posts pick it up. NSA picks it up. They say, we need a warning. They warn Bush. He does nothing. Now, again, I'm not buying the official story, obviously, but to say that Bush, you know, a real president might have been able to stop 9/11 by ordering probes, by shaking the tree, right, by rattling the cages up and down the bureaucracy, that might have been possible, but Bush obviously did none of that. Anyway, Maher was going to go on television Friday night and out a series of Republican pedophiles prominent in Washington, D.C. He had gone on Larry King several days before and noted that Ken Mailman, the head of the Republican National Committee,
right,
was a homosexual.
Exactly.
And he promised more, and he never did. So was he threatened? I suppose he was.
Sure.
But I think that would be the answer to that. Anyway, let's get the main thing, though, is this would have been the way to destroy, to begin the destruction of the Republican Party, by exposing the fact, and there are two questions here. One is pedophilia, because that, I think, is the main thing that's going on. A lot of these Republican office holders are actually, in order to be sponsored, they've got to be taped in flagrante delicto, pedophilia. Because otherwise, the people who are paying, unless they have those tapes, feel that these politicians are not controllable. Why should I invest millions of dollars if I'm a banker? Why should I invest millions of dollars in the career of a politician if he can turn around and dump me? I've got to have blackmail material to control them. So I can say, yeah, you dump me, I destroy you. So don't do it. And they engage in this. So this is the Craig Spence ring back in 1989, the Omaha question, and then the Gosh Gannon stuff from last year. It's a continuous process. That's pedophilia. Now, the homosexuality part, I think, is a little bit more complicated argument. The issue there is, if there is a secret homosexual clique or camarilla running, let's say, the House of Representatives, That is a matter of urgent public interest. And the interest is not so much on the homosexual part as on the secret clique or camarilla or cabal. It could be a cabal of vegetarians, of pinochle players, of stamp collectors, of mountain bikers. It can be anything you want. But if there's a secret cabal of people who control an organ, one branch of government, or part of it, that has to be known to the public. That is perfectly legitimate. And whatever the basis of this cabal becomes a matter of very, very legitimate, indeed urgent, public interest. So that they could have done that. The Republicans could have been really hit with that. The Democrats seem to be constitutionally incapable of exploiting such things. But now let's look at the current situation. The most likely scenario is that the Republican Party is in the process of collapsing. Why? First of all, they're cut off from a significant part of the money spigot. The Republican Party has absolutely no values left. They don't stand for anything. They stand for power and money. And this is not enough, right? Their failures are too numerous to mention. The other question is, the two exploding bombs are, number one, the large part of the Republican base are Christian fundamentalists. The leadership are involved with pedophile cliques or a homosexual cabal,
mm-hmm.
and this is poison. So this is an explosive factor. The other thing is the Republican base has worked itself up into a hysteria about foreign workers, illegal aliens, Mexican immigrants, what have you, partly because this is how they feel so threatened economically. But they want to act it out in this way, typical scapegoating and demagoguery. Whereas the Wall Street and country club leadership of the Republican Party want more foreign workers because they see them as scabs and strike breakers and ways to drive down wages. So this is an explosive contradiction. The most likely way the Republican Party blows up is over this hatred of Mexicans issue, because you've now got what seems to me to be a fascist militia, the Minutemen, active on the border, right? But this is the same pattern we saw with Italian fascism and indeed the German Nazis, an armed group of disgruntled war veterans who go to the border, be it Denuncio in Fiume in 1919 or the Freikorps in the Baltic around the same time. And they then become the spawning ground for the customs and the methods and the slogans, the salutes, right? The paraphernalia and trappings of the fascist movement. So we've got all that. And then we've got a demagogue like Tancredo, congressman from Colorado, runs on a pure xenophobic anti-foreigner line and says that he will be a candidate for president in 2008 unless some established figure does what he says, which is to build a Berlin Wall with, you know, machine guns and watchtowers and minefields and the rest of this, and then also the massive deportation of 10 million or 15 million foreign workers from the U.S. It's just, it would guarantee a police state. Whatever you think of this issue, it would mean a police state in this country, you know, without the shadow of a doubt. So if you don't want a police state, you can't make this the main issue. I could solve this through various means, but maybe we'll talk about that another time.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll have time to come back to it.
I'd like to just take a moment here and just ask you a couple of questions now that you've...
Fire away.
First of all, I'd like to just speculate and find out what speculation are you... And agreed, it's speculation. It's not. We're not nailing anything to the doors of the Wittenberg Church here, but just
which I don't approve
just
of.
Speculating. Just speculating now. Is it true that a large number of workers have contracted cancer?
Lenny, you're leading me into areas I don't know anything about.
Okay.
Why don't you let me stick to
what
my...
is the... Okay, I just... You don't want to speculate about what was the technology that actually brought down the World Trade Centers. Okay.
This is obviously...
I'm just wondering, since you were at the conference, is no one at the conference projecting various theories as to what really was used, what high-tech equipment was really used, what sort of computer this was a high-tech military operation.
I would say, basically, you know, it's clearly controlled demolition of the classical type. However, it also has the thermite element, something that I discuss in my book, I had thermite already in, you know,
well,
October
we don't have to we don't have to come down with the exact name, but certainly everybody
understood that it was a
high-tech explosive device.
Yes, in other words, controlled demolition charges thermite, and then there's the question, is there something more involved? Are there, for example, advanced physical principles, new physical principles being used? I certainly couldn't rule that out. But if you want to go on C-SPAN and say that, or CNN, you better have a cogent argument. Now,
well, I have no difficulty understanding
it.
I have no.
Go into New Hampshire. Yeah. We're going to make this political. If you go to New Hampshire, and this is what's going to happen, you'll find now, this year, 2007, oligarch politicians in the retail political mode. And if we just had Mayor Giuliani declare his candidacy for president, or he's going to, he's testing the waters. If you meet Giuliani in New Hampshire, think of all the wonderful questions you can ask him. You could say, hey, Mayor Giuliani, why did you violate federal law by destroying the crime scene? Why didn't you treat that as a crime scene and a crash scene?
Yeah.
You violated two sets of federal laws.
Yeah, exactly.
You did it. Why did you play the fireman against the policeman with your scoop and dump,
right,
which led to a riot? They say, oh, he's a uniter, not a divider. Uh-uh. He's a divider. He caused a riot, a fist fight between the police and the fireman at the site because he insisted on scoop and dump, didn't care about recovering the bodies because he was in such a hurry to destroy the evidence, which would have led us into precisely this area. And the other thing, as you point out, hey, Mayor Giuliani, why did you say that the air was safe to breathe when it was full of asbestos and carcinogens and all the rest of this stuff? That's now a huge, huge issue. I have been less interested in that because it does not bear directly on 9/11. But once you get Giuliani making a political comeback, it becomes a huge issue. And that's where all of these people in New York City with their lawsuits and the obvious lies of the government turn into something important. But let me just get back to some of the points that I think people have to know. In addition, and we can maybe talk some
sure,
about
Webster, the take it away.
Go political ahead. Perspective. Don't believe the story that the Democrats therefore won because they didn't oppose the war. The reason the Democrats won is because of Murtha, Congressman Murtha. He ought to be the Speaker of the House. If he can't be the Speaker of the House, he's got to be the Majority Leader, and certainly not somebody like Steny Hoyer, who stands for absolutely nothing except money and power on the Democratic side. It's also important that Jane Harman, tainted by the Mossad, be kicked out of the House Intelligence Committee and that Alcee Hastings come in. So we have all this. Also remember, the reason that Lieberman won was not because Lamont talked about the war, but because Lamont did not talk about the war. As soon as the primary was over, Hillary Clinton came in and she said, oh my God, I've got to save Lieberman because Lieberman is just like me. He's a neocon warmonger Democrat. And if he goes down to defeat, that will hurt my chances for the presidency. So Hillary sent in her advisors and she said to Lamont in Connecticut, first of all, stop attacking Lieberman. We'll convince him to drop out. That was for the first two, three, 4 weeks. So from August to September, Lamont held his fire, and they kept telling him Lieberman would quit. Lieberman did not quit. These were lies told by Hillary's advisors.
Okay.
Then Hillary's advisors began to say, Lamont, you know, you could do well with the anti-Iraq stuff in the primary, but when it comes now to the senatorial election, you got to be senatorial. You got to talk about a broad range of issues. Stop talking about Iraq. Now, poor Lamont, this is the J.P. Morgan fortune, right? Thomas Lamont was famous partner of J.P. Morgan and the rest of the family, too, over the years.
Yeah.
So he's a dummy. He's a silver spoon oligarch, doesn't know what he's doing. He listens to this and goes senatorial. This allows Lieberman to muddy the waters, making it look like Lieberman is really more anti-war than Lamont. And because of the stupidity and cowardice of Lamont and his gullibility in accepting these advisors, that's how Lieberman won. So all of this. Now, obviously the urgent thing right now is oversight hearings. There's got to be oversight on about three dozen urgent issues: Iraq, Iran, Katrina, energy, gasoline prices, Q04, Supreme Court corruption, as Sherman Skolnick pointed out, FISA, illegal wiretaps, totalitarian measures, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo. I won't go through the whole list, but you can imagine. You name your favorite issue, pharmaceutical giveaways, the donut hole in the pharmaceutical giveaways. This is endless. So you have all of these themes where vigorous hearings have to be held. I have already put out, I think, the scenario that the likely way it's going to go is the Congress will try to institute normal traditional oversight. They'll invite members of the administration to testify, bring documents. They'll refuse. Then the Congress will have to issue subpoenas saying, Gonzalez, you show up and you bring these documents about torture, about the Geneva Convention, whatever it is. They'll say, no, we're the unitary executive. We don't do that. At that point, you'll get contempt of Congress citations, and you'll get the path to impeachment opened up. And it doesn't matter what Pelosi says, because it's the institutional dynamic that will take her along. Kanye has also said he wanted impeachment. Now he says he doesn't because Pelosi leaned on him. Doesn't matter what he says either. The whole thing is headed for impeachment simply by the logic of the institutional positions, also because Bush will veto all their legislation. So that's one phase. Now, on the question of the Iraq War, what you've had after the elections is a democratic success, but then a coup d'etat. We've had a coup d'etat in the past 7 days here in the United States.
Right.
It's a creeping coup, it's a cold coup, but it's a coup. And it's the coup d'etat of the Iraq Study Group. Now that sounds, Iraq Study Group sounds vaguely reassuring.
That's
doesn't
Baker.
Sound threatening.
In other words, huh? Baker.
Yeah, Baker. It's the commission. Let me just mention it for people who have not studied the whole.
James Baker III.
Yeah, James Baker III. James Baker III, of course, is the stooge. I wouldn't actually. He's. It's the other way around. Bush 41 is the stooge of Baker. Baker was the idea man for Reagan and for Bush 41, but above all for Bush 41, he was the White House chief of staff.
Under Haig.
I have to point this out.
Yep.
If you're going to switch from an electoral college dominated by this reactionary bloc of southern states, there's got to be an alternative to that. And I think these last elections have also indicated what that will be. On the one side, this solid south of the Republicans has gotten smaller. It's been chipped away. If you look at states like Virginia, like Tennessee, like Florida, like Arkansas, you'll see that in each one of those, there's either a Democratic governor or a Democratic senator. Missouri, mm-hmm. Another one. So the Missouri Senate seat went to the Democrats. The Virginia Senate seat went to the Democrats. In Florida, you had a Democrat reelected. So there's that. The solid South is shrinking, and I think that leaves it open for an election block that would go from New England and the Northeast across the Midwest, the Upper Midwest, the Great Plains, because the Senate seat in Montana went to the Democrats. A big surprise. And then we get this area, sort of the Intermountain West, the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Coast. And couple of years ago, all those governors were Republicans, but now there are 5 Democratic governors in those states, and Wyoming almost went Democratic, came very, very close to going Democratic in the statewide Congress seat, and in Arizona and these other places, you've got a significant Hispanic voting bloc, who, of course, are horrified by the racism of the Republicans. They're going to gravitate, I think, increasingly Democratic. So I think that plus California and Oregon and Washington would give you a majority voting bloc that would be progressive and not reactionary. The Republican Party is now increasingly tied to this reactionary southern bloc with these Baptists and religious fundamentalists and so forth. And even there, the relation is, because of the pedophilia issue, is very strained. So the perspectives of the Republicans are quite grim. Now, let me just say, the coup d'etat now of the
The
Baker-Hamilton Commission, again, who they are. It's James Baker III, right? He's been chief of staff for Reagan and Bush. He's been secretary of the Treasury. He's been secretary of state. But he's also the one who masterminded the Bush coup in November, December 2000, right? The stolen election was the work of Baker. Then we've got Lee Hamilton, and we all know him. He's the greatest cover-up artist in the government.
Yeah, and
this
another,
goes from Iran-Contra all the way to 9/11.
And he goes back to Warren Commission.
Does he? I guess he probably does.
Oh, yeah. He's got
a long checkered career.
Yes.
Then we have Vernon Jordan, is an influence peddler in the black community. Al Simpson is the former congressman from Wyoming. I guess he's a link to Cheney. Chuck Robb, Lyndon B. Johnson's son-in-law, a Democratic hack from Virginia. Lawrence Eagleburger is a clear invisible government type. He's Kissinger Associates, former Secretary of State. Leon Panetta is an ecological extremist from one of the richest congressional districts in California, who then became chief of staff for Clinton. You've got Sandra Day O'Connor, former woman Republican justice of the Supreme Court. William Perry, Clinton's defense secretary, something of a madman these days, wants to bomb North Korea if they dare to test ballistic missiles. My God, this is quite an arrogant imperialist stance. And then Robert Gates. And, of course, the important thing is, right now this, we'll get to Gates in a second, this Iraq study group has become the government of the United States. I think that seems to be the overwhelming tendency. We'll see whether Bush, Cheney, in particular Cheney, can fight back with this. Now, this implies a number of things. First of all, it means that there's been a shift inside the ruling elite behind the scenes that you don't see. For quite a number of years, I would say going back to the late 90s, maybe 97, 98, for almost 10 years, the spokesman for the banking establishment, the ruling oligarchical elite of the United States, was George Shultz, who had been Secretary of Labor, Secretary of the Treasury,
right.
Secretary of State,
yep.
Hoover Institution.
Sir George Shultz, right.
Well, this is the guy who chose Schwarzenegger, chose Bush, chose Cheney, chose the Vulcans, chose Condoleezza,
right.
Chose Wolfowitz, chose them all.
Right.
Again, not him, but the forces that were arrayed behind him.
Yes.
Now it would seem that the predominance inside the ruling elite is passing from Shultz to Baker in terms of the elder statesman, the spokesman for this oligarchical consensus. Now, because you can see, Bush, Cheney say, we don't talk to Syria, we don't talk to Iraq. To Iran, sorry. Baker says, we do. We talk to Syria, we talk to Iran, we talk to all of them because we're looking for ways to get out of Iraq and to somehow solve this problem. And then they become the great beneficiaries of the election defeat of the Bush coalition because what happens then is that, of course, Rumsfeld is forced out and they bring in Robert Gates. Now, Robert Gates is portrayed as a family servant of the Bushes. Again, so is Baker. I think this sort of turns things on their head, because what Gates represents is the invisible government. Indeed, this entire Baker-Hamilton operation, the Iraq Study Group, is the invisible government. It's an arm of hacks and stooges and running dogs and functionaries of the invisible government.
So is Baker,
very dangerous.
So
very
say,
dangerous for them to come out in the open
Baker's
and
like
basically
a...
appear. And I can see a lot of Republicans are enraged and puzzled about the fact that it's now obviously the Iraq State Group that's running the United States and not the so-called elected Bush Cheney.
Is Baker like the viceroy, the Mountbatten of the country?
I don't know. It's not yet.
He's very powerful, obviously.
It's not him as an individual. Remember, this is a polycentric oligarchical system. There is no dictator. There won't be if these people have their way. Again, what it shows is that Bush, Cheney were puppets. I used to have fights with people in the 9/11 movement because I'd say, Bush is clearly a puppet, and Cheney is also a puppet. And they'd say, what, Cheney a puppet? No, Cheney rules the United States. Well, ridiculous. And now if you look at Wayne Madsen report, you'll see that he has a scenario whereby Cheney is actually forced out by plea bargains involving Rove and Scooter Libby. In other words, he'll get the Spiro Agnew treatment to be forced out and then replaced by somebody else who might then become the president. Now, the question is, if the Iraq Study Group, speaking for the establishment, says, time to get out of Iraq, and little Bushy thinks he's president and says no, He will be impeached. He will be liquidated in some very, very rapid manner.
Why would he ever go against his dad's close associate?
Again, I don't think the soap opera explanation is the one. See, the soap opera of the father and the son, the Oedipal conflict of the son with the father, I think this is beside the point. You have a clique of neocon fascist madmen around Bush. They've kept him in a bubble. The father, of course, is a madman in his own right. There's
right.
not that there's really a big difference of principle.
Right.
It's only the question of imperialist survival,
uh-huh.
Where the older one thinks that it's again. Remember that Bush 41 and 43 are both puppets of this thing you don't see.
Right.
And that is what is acting. It's not that Bush 41 is the spokesman of the establishment. He is not. He is an aging man with a hyperthyroid condition who, you know, can't do any significant heavy work. And when you see somebody like Eagleburger or Gates come forward, they do so not as the agents of Bush the Elder, but as functionaries of the invisible government. Now,
you feel that Gates would be Bush 41's handler?
No, he is there simply to assert a change of policy. And again, if Bush the Younger refuses to go along, he'll be dumped. That's very, very clear. Now, what might this be? All of this neocon rhetoric about democracy and staying the course and finishing the job and victory, Bush is still yelling about victory. The Republicans in general are still talking victory at a time when encirclement and military annihilation, as we've shown in a previous program, is actually on the agenda. You've also got Tony Blair coming into the picture. This is important, too. Tony Blair has now had a teleconference with the Iraq Study Group today. Today being Tuesday, the 14th of November. And in this, Blair says, we want to involve Iran. It's also important that, we'll get to Gates in a second, but that when Peter Pace of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top military guy, he's got to be interviewed by the Iraq Study Group. Just this week, we've had Olmert come in from Israel, come into the White House, tell Bush what he wants. So little Bush gets jerked in the old way by Olmert into confrontation and war in the Middle East,
yeah,
of a certain kind. And then the next day, the Iraq Study Group comes to the White House, and little Bush gets jerked in the other direction. Again, this is roiling a lot of conservatives because they see what's happening. There are also certain Democratic politicians like Senator Carl Levin who are saying, we're going to start to pull out within 3 to 4 months. And the Republicans are going wild, saying, who gave you that power? Well, it's not the power of Levin. It's that Levin is aligning with the Iraq Study Group. Now, let's just look at Gates. Gates is obviously a hack. Gates stands for no policy. He's not a realist. He's not a neocon. He's a nothing. He's a running dog and a stooge. And, of course, he goes back. He's a stooge and servant of William Casey during Iran-Contra. That means he's involved in gun running, drug running, and death squads. Then he gets to the CIA. He is the founder of Al-Qaeda. This is the thing that I would stress most about Robert Gates. You can go to my book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in USA. I quote Robert Gates, his memoir, Out of the Shadows, The Ultimate Insider's Memoir. And he says, yes, in the 80s, we decided to create an international brigade of the most radical Mujahideen elements from all of the Arab and Islamic countries so they could go to Afghanistan and fight the Soviets. And then we thought about it, and then we said we wouldn't do it. But, of course, they did do it. And that international brigade is indeed Al-Qaeda, the CIA's own Arab Legion. So you're talking about Gates, the man who presided over the foundation of Al-Qaeda. He's got these other problems. In 1987, Bush the Elder tried to make him the head of the CIA. He couldn't get through confirmation hearings. He was too filthy dirty. There was Sam Nunn and some others began asking questions. Bush the Elder said, oh, my God, if this guy starts to spill the beans, I won't make it in 1988. Let's put him on ice, bring him back, as they did in 91, I guess it was. And then they finally made him the head of the CIA because all the Democrats were willing to roll over because they had been terrified by Bush's ability to destroy Jim Wright, the Speaker of the House. So Capitol Hill by that time had been terrorized. So my word to everybody is stop Gates. Gates is absolutely unacceptable. We don't want functionaries of the invisible government, Iran-Contra criminals, Al-Qaeda founders, people who cook the intelligence. Even George Shultz in his memoir says this is a guy who cooked the intelligence. He would fix the intelligence to fit the policy. We've had enough of that, haven't we?
Sure, this is exactly Webster.
What we don't need. So filibuster Gates. If the Democrats roll over for Gates, that's a very, very bad sign. He's filthy dirty. He was so filthy dirty he had to drop out in 1987. Why should he be acceptable today? And I think there are, at least I've seen some Democrats, Levin and Feinstein, seem to be very suspicious of this guy, even though Biden is falling all over himself to get him in. Now, let's ask ourselves, what might the policy of the Iraq Study Group be? And it seems to me it's the following. On the surface, there are two alternatives. One is vilify the Iraqis, blame Maliki, say these are subhuman untermenschen and they'll never have democracy, so we're leaving, let them die.
Yeah.
That would be one version. You can hear elements of that in the mass media.
Sure.
The other one, they claim, would be a reasonable alternative to say, have a regional peace conference, bring in Syria, bring in Iran. Naturally, the Israelis are going to fight that tooth and nail.
Yeah.
Because any cooperation from Iran and Syria would be bought with Israeli concessions. The bill for this would be sent to the Israelis. It would be wonderful to see this happen. I don't think this is what is happening. Because the Syrians would say, fine, we'll help you, we want the Golan. And the Iranians and the Syrians would say, fine, we'll help you. You create a Palestinian state on a serious basis. You stop the occupation, inviolable borders, not a Bantustan, none of this stuff. That won't happen. And the Iranians, of course, would then say, stop with your sanctions. We're going to have nuclear energy, and there's nothing you can legally do about it. That's one level, those two possibilities. Now, obviously, I would be in favor of a general Middle East peace conference, and I've talked about that before. Here, I think this is now the underlying reality. Given the fact that these people are geopolitical thinkers, they are, in other words, they're criminals, I think the strategy of the Baker-Hamilton Commission is something like this, and I've seen this sketched. This is sort of, you know, two or three sentences here and there from the Washington Post over the last 10 or 15 days.
Right.
They say what they want to do, first of all, is to flip Syria. They want to detach Syria from Iran. And then having separated Syria from Iran, broken this alliance, which went on, say, you know, during the whole 1980s, during the Iran-Iraq war, they say, we're going to create a Sunni alliance against Iran and, indeed, part of Iraq. It's something like this. I imagine Iran remaining a theater of war under this basis, but the U.S. would depart because they say, well, we've destroyed Iraq. That was our goal. We've done it. And we can start a regional war and make Iraq the battlefield. So much the better. That will solve the Israeli predicament because it'll mean that all of their main enemies are at war. The goal, I think, will be to try to create a Sunni bloc against Iran, and the Sunni bloc would be composed of Syria, Saudi Arabia, and the other countries of the old Gulf Cooperation Council, with all those emirates that are afraid of Iran, right, from Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Kuwait and Qatar and Oman and all of them. So Saudi Arabia, Gulf Cooperation Council, Syria, plus Jordan, if at all possible, plus Egypt, if possible, and the Iraqi Sunnis, who would be the front line of this. And they'd then be fighting Iran plus the large Shiite component of Iraq. So there would be a regional conflagration that would balance the region, destroy the region, weaken everybody, preserve the Israelis. And the other included thing is something like this. There's also a strong anti-Russian component in the Iraq Study Group. Remember that Gates, in addition to being a stooge for William Casey and the Bush family, is also a dyed-in-the-wool stooge of Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Uh-huh.
And Brzezinski has always argued that the neocon, pro-Israeli Zionist futzing around in the Middle East was bad news because it would weaken the U.S. and many other things. Brzezinski's argument has always been, if you crush Moscow, you rule the world, and everything else will be easy after that. So why not go after Moscow while you still can? Because he obviously realizes that Moscow is getting stronger, the U.S. is getting weaker. The Russians, of course, have been extremely negative about the Democratic Party. They look at people like Holbrooke and Brzezinski and the Harrimanites in general as more interested in confrontation with Russia than with wars in the Middle East. Because they don't share this neocon notion that Israel is the center of the world. The Brzezinskiites don't. So Putin made a statement on the day after the election. He spoke to the GRU, the Soviet military intelligence, and he said, the potential for conflict is increasing in the world. We've got violence and force as the main element of international life out of all proportion brought to us by one group of states who control the world mass media. So it's obviously the Anglo-Americans and the Israeli tale on that, apanage. So I think the Russian angle is very, very big. And this is why I think the Iraq study group must be defeated. Gates has got to be defeated. And beyond this, in order to roll back these people, we've got to have more 9/11 truth. Now, here's how I would do it. When these candidates, like Giuliani, go into New Hampshire, they will be confronted by citizens with questions and videotapes, and all of these issues with Giuliani will be brought up. McCain is, of course, a madman. McCain and Lieberman are calling for more troops for Iraq. This is even worse than the Iraq study group. McCain has got to be asked, hey, McCain, why did you write that filthy, lying introduction to the Popular Mechanics defense of the 9/11 myth and slander attack on the 9/11 truth movement? And then we've got to be able to take the issue into the halls of Congress, and we're going to do this, as Bob Bowman has talked about. We don't have we could have had Bob Bowman elected if Rombozo had forked over $500,000 or $1 million, but he didn't want that, obviously. So what we have to do now is, for example, Pelosi says she wants to implement the Cain-Hamilton-Zelikow Commission in the first 100 hours. That's no good. We've got to have the overthrowing of the Cain-Hamilton-Zelikow. Why? Because they were told about Able Danger, at least they were told something about Able Danger by the Able Danger people, as Congressman Weldon pointed out. He was destroyed in these elections precisely because he brought this up. And, of course, the Cain-Hamilton-Zelikow Commission completely suppressed all the evidence on Able Danger, lied then, lied about it later. We've also got from Bob Woodward's recent book, The State of Denial, that George Tenet Kofor Black had an emergency meeting with Condi in early August or late July 2001, where they said, we think an attack is imminent. Condi lied about it, covered it up. Cain Hamilton Zelikow covered that all up. That was Zelikow covering up for Condi, obviously. Then we also know from Cain Hamilton's book, they said they knew that the NORAD and Pentagon generals were lying. They were committing perjury, but they decided to do nothing about it.
Right.
So those are three documented institutional, official, mainstream facts that mean that the Cain Hamilton Zelikow is a tissue of lies, even before you get to the hundreds of others that I have in my book. Another one that's interesting is, as part of the commission itself, there are a number of these, but the Picard-Ashcroft interchange. Picard, acting director of the FBI, says, Ashcroft told me he didn't want to hear another word about Al-Qaeda. Ashcroft said, that's a lie. One of them is lying, probably Ashcroft. Where's the perjury? Where's the perjury rap against Ashcroft? Now, of course, we know that if you want to start from official, documented, mainstream facts and tear down the 9/11 myth, there are three, I would think, that are very interesting. First of all, Angel is next. The threat to Bush, and now that we've seen how much of a puppet Bush is, this is, I think, coming back. The Secret Service, Air Force One, received this threat. Angel, Air Force One, is next. We're going to attack Bush unless he does what we want. This is admitted by William Safire. Those leaks came from Cheney. Everybody knows it. Uh-huh. This thing was acknowledged by Condoleezza Rice, the head of the National Security Council on national television. So this has got to be investigated and the code words that came in with it. That's one. Then we have the Catatonia issue, the whitewash issue. We've had the Clinton-Chris Wallace exchange. We've had Hillary getting into the act. All about if Bush got these warnings, why didn't he act? Bill Maher, the comedian, has been on the Scarborough Country, saying that he wants Bush impeached because when Bush was told that the country was under attack, he just sat there. He didn't do anything.
Exactly.
He didn't jump. He didn't go into action. So we have all of that, this entire complex, right? This is obviously something that a congressional committee could take very seriously. It's not speculative. It's all documented on film. And then there's the other one, what we saw in the Vanity Fair issue in August or September. In the Vanity Fair issue of August and September, we find that at the needs, the Northeast Air Defense Center, part of NORAD, that's controlling the main area, these people are completely disoriented by the fact that there are these drills. Is it real or the drill? We've now got, you know, quite a number of tapes that have been made public, published in Vanity Fair. You can hear all this online. You go to the Vanity Fair website, you can hear it. They're all saying, hey, did the drill start early? The hijacking is not supposed to begin for another hour, whatever it is. This is another area where the Kane, Hamilton, Zelikow Commission absolutely struck out. So all of this is a way to say to Pelosi, forget about the Kane, Hamilton, Zelikow Commission. It's a tissue of lies. Don't make your issue to implement it, but to overthrow it and replace it. You've got to have serious 9/11 hearings, which we've never had, and they've got to start from Angel is next, the catatonia of Bush, the nonfeasance all during August, and then the existence of these drills, which were the explosive element that was completely covered up in the 9/11, you know, the Kane Hamilton Commission. So all of this stuff is key, because if we get 9/11 truth, I think the perspective becomes quite reasonable that the party realignment could go in a progressive New Deal sort of direction. But if we don't get this, we could very easily have, in spite of everything, a party realignment into fascism, and this can be done under Democratic auspices just as easily as under Republican ones, when you have people like Lantos and Lieberman and Hillary running around with their warmonger line. We obviously need to support Murtha and the people I would call the moderate imperialists, no illusions about them, but the ones who say get out of Iraq and do this in some fairly rapid way. But above all, we've got to fight the Iraq Study Group, because that is a putschist group who is they are carrying out a creeping coup, and I think there are lots and lots of conservative Republicans even who don't want to vote for Robert Gates, indeed should not, for their own reasons, different reasons, maybe the wrong reasons, but still, any reason to vote against Robert Gates is a good one. And the Republicans need to do something also from their own point of view to stop the coup d'etat of the Iraq Study Group, because that is the invisible government of financiers, the Morgan Group, and the British backers, as we see, with Tony Blair sort of joining in with the Iraq Study Group and trying to dictate a policy which on the surface looks like it's a pullout from Iraq, but underneath, I'm telling you, is most likely this thing about flipping Syria and creating a Sunni bloc and having a nice, huge regional war in the Middle East that would then tend to degenerate into a world war, whatever these fine meddlers of the Baker-Hamilton Commission might think right now.
Well, listen, thanks, Webster. I mean, what a great synopsis and review of what's gone on and a sort of an insight into what to look for in the future. And, I mean, once again, we want to thank you for bringing your treasury of wisdom to Cloak and Dagger.
Again, if you want to get my book, Amazon.com, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in USA, selling very well all during the summer. Also, The Unauthorized Biography of George Bush is a printed book. If you want to get that also online, www.tarpley.net, you can read the whole book for free, read the Omaha chapter, read the stuff about Robert Gates being too smelly to get through the hearings in 1987. It's all in there. And I'll send you, people may be interested, I'll send you a very interesting map that we did for the Washington conference we had here in Arlington.
Yes, send it on, please.
Which is the threatened encirclement of the U.S. forces in Iraq. Unless they move fast, because that's the last thing is, of course, that the real war in the background is not proceeding according to the timetable of the Iraq Study Group. In other words, the U.S. forces are in a very critical situation. They're in danger of being encircled and annihilated, as I pointed out in a previous broadcast. And somehow, even these invisible government hacks, let alone Bush, don't seem to realize how critical, how urgent it is to start getting the U.S. forces out, but to do it with a regional peace conference that would begin to address the actual issues in the Middle East, not start a regional war.
Webster, it's been an honor. We look forward to having you back again next week. Thanks very much for being
See
here
soon,
at Cloak
Lenny.
And Dagger. Good night.
Bye-bye.